Most people who decide to adopt a healthier lifestyle think first about the amount of exercise they're getting and about the types of food they're eating. But according to Don Campbell, changing what we listen to every day can have a major impact on our health and well-being. Mr. Campbell is the author of 23 books, including the bestseller, The Mozart Effect. His latest, Healing at the Speed of Sound, which he co-wrote with Alex Doman, is published by Hudson Street Press, and I'm happy it has brought him to our show today. Welcome.
Good morning.
Later in the show, we will be taking listener calls about your experiences with sounds and any questions you might have for Don Campbell. The phone number is 646-829-3985. Your book is getting uniformly rave reviews from readers on Amazon and the Barnes & Noble websites. It's averaging 5 stars on both of them, and some people are even claiming that it's changed their lives. Why do you think so many of us underestimate the impact of how and what we hear and listen to every day makes us feel?
Well, we just live in an overwhelm of sound. 100 years ago, 150 years ago, we were just not over-inundated. The World Health Organization just published something in the last paper, 125-page paper, in the last 3 months that will change our world. It is on the effects of noise and health in Europe. And it is such a powerful paper. Anybody can just Google WHO, World Health Organization, and noise, and you will come to it. And, you know, we've been working with secondhand smoke and air. The second greatest pollutant in the world today is about noise.
Well, I can't remember ever seeing a TV drama set in New York where there wasn't at least one scene with a siren in the background. Even though I often will go through many days without sirens in the background. But that is our sense of what city life is like.
It's unbelievable. I took the one down here today from 86th Street, and literally, it is so abusive. There are wonderful books that have come out in the last 2 or 3 years. What I've really done in
abusive
healing
in what way? You mean the sound of the subway?
Oh, it's 110 decibels. And it really scrambles our brain. In Pursuit of Silence, 0 decibels. Stephen Foy's book is fantastic, just about how we are assaulted by sound. Go into your home. Look around. It's the air conditioning, the heating, the cell phone, the computer, all of those things. And, you know, I come at this as a classical musician. I come into this world from being a performer and a teacher and a journalist. And the thing that gets me is that the brain is so busy filtering out sounds so that we can truly communicate. And silence becomes actually one of the greatest components of health that we can find.
We often hear about musical ability being related to proficiency in math and science, but you've cited a study that showed that music majors scored better in reading than students in any other major, including English. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think these studies are very important. I also know the time of day of the study, the age of the kids, and where they live, how loud is the whole environment, also makes a big difference. But if you look at reading and writing and change the pace in which the auditory world, just using a metronome in the background for a second, third, fourth grader learning to read aloud. It changes.
That would have driven me mad in the fourth grade.
It could have, or it could have given you crutches that allowed you to reassemble the way you think and organize and not feel rushed. So it can be both and. Your point is
perfect. Well, you've written that musicians' brains develop differently than the brains of non-musicians. Is it similar to the way athletes' bodies are different from those of non-athletes?
I think it is. And I think every musician is different. jazz musicians are just aware of this whole magnificent panoply of sounds. And I always think of a jazz musician as being the perfect example of how to drive in Los Angeles. It's, you can't get on the freeway. You have to know all the back streets and how to be creative and not go berserk just driving around. When I was 13, I entered the Paris Conservatory of Music, and I studied with Nadia Boulanger. And she would just make listening so rigorous. And I'll never forget the solfège classes in those early years where they would play the whole piano, Annette Dudonné, going all over the keyboard and then sing la. I think that the musician's brain, you can be a linear musician where you depend on reading the score and following the rules. You can be a spontaneous musician. And I think that musical brain is interesting because like 11 of the 12 cranial nerves all have a secondary response to sound. And I think that's the most fascinating point.
Have studies been done, MRIs been done, comparing musicians' brains to the rest of us?
Yes. And I think these different scans are very curious because we didn't quite have these clues early in the process of what gives someone a good ear. A great ear may not always be a musical ear, but it's an ear that has developed a technique called selectivity, being able to filter out sounds. And the brain itself is a mechanism so you filter out what you don't want to listen to.
This has been a problem for people with hearing aids because they hear everything equally. But the rest of us just filter out all the things that are irrelevant to the moment?
We can or we can't. It depends on the medication.
If it's too loud,
we have no
choice.
It depends on the food. Many children who are hyperactive and with ADHD, they hear every sound. And just having noise reduction headphones, noise cancellation headphones, can help them read and concentrate, not playing music at all, just finding where their own voice within.
Scientists have observed that in musicians. The corpus callosum, the trunk-like bundle of neurons that connects the two brain hemispheres, is significantly larger than in non-musicians. Why is that?
Well, it's because language and music, tonality, rhythm, and melodic context are so loaded with information. For instance, you go to a foreign country, or si vous allez à Paris, pour manger jusqu'à pour déjeuner, all of your auditory systems change a little bit. When you begin to listen to rap or hip-hop, you put an organization in the sound and you find a new way to get around the information. In other words, many students and adults, even elders with Alzheimer's, when you change the musical rhythm of the speech, sometimes they're able to organize it better. The whole auditory sense of how the brain, language, the larynx, and different levels of music. Last night, I've got to tell you, I went to the new Star Theater at Alice Tully Hall to hear the St. Petersburg Symphony Orchestra. Oh my gosh, there's nothing like that rich, rich, wonderful string sound. They were doing also the Prokofiev piano concerto. Well, I was very wise online. I bought a ticket in the center of row G, and I was very happy until I got there. And this is the row that is underneath the piano. I had a cat's eye view of the pianist. The piano was no more than 4 feet away from me. That sound was so powerful. I had a very different experience. And in the
You're saying an unbalanced experience.
But it was magnificent. But it was so much. It was like so rich. In the last chapter of Healing at the Speed of Sound, over the last 5 years, I've been the lecturer and director of education for the Philharmonic Orchestra, where I live in Colorado. And we've developed 20 different ways to listen to music. It's called the Super Listening Club. And what I have found is if we psychologically understand what's happened physiologically in the listening process, we can actually change and modify the wellness of listening.
Well, you mentioned language earlier, and everyone knows that if you learn a language, a second language, when you're very young, you learn it better than when you're older. What about music? I've heard that the corpus callosum shows differences where people in adults where they had begun studying music before the age of 8 or 7. That's different than if you start later.
I think music is not just a universal language. I think it is 10,000 different languages. I was born in a house of music where no one read music. My father would play the piano and the accordion and the harmonica and just sing everything. And I lived under the piano until I was 6 to go to school. I loved all of those kinds of sounds. It's about the ear and how one can discriminate with sound, because the music within language, the music within movement, the ability to integrate and think musically with these musical components gives our life a wider spectrum. This is why early childhood music, music together, kinder music, is so vital for a child.
Well, there was a time when the schools all taught music. A listener, in fact, asked, what about choral reading for elementary school students, which he did in the 1950s? Did that help with learning?
I'm sure.
Why is it no longer being done?
Orff Schulwerk. I think the arts are far more important than the performance or just the entertainment. They actually build the connections within the brain. It's not just about music. It's about emotion. It's about being connected. It's being expressive. And the idea of using music to heal is not about curing. It's just bringing ourselves to balance day in and day out and realize that the brain needs to rest. The emotions need to be held in a way that are not radical, but simple.
Well, Dan in Chelsea, who's an architect, says, as architects, we purposely add sound like air conditioning to interior spaces to drain out other random noise with a constant one in hotels. We do the same in open offices to give greater privacy to those working from others on the phones or in conferences. Bars and restaurants also play music to make their customers feel a greater sense of privacy. And he says, go into one with no sound and you're likely to turn right around. But you're suggesting that there is a place for total silence.
I think it depends on if you really want to have a wonderful conversation with whoever you're with. I mean, we buy space. We heard a little familiar Bach piece to begin the segment on the harp, the
prelude,
first
number,
prelude
one in
number
C.
One in C major. And that is a very different environment. Sound is used to mask other sounds, but you pile so much sound upon sound, and we really are developing something that scares us.
Einstein played a violin, but then so did Jack Benny. But you learned that almost all of the leading technical designers and engineers in the Silicon Valley are practicing musicians.
There's something about the vocabulary of music that helps us focus and express something that words and ideas are limited. I think everybody has a musical ability, but that doesn't mean you have to perform for anyone, whether that is just humming or whether it is really taking up an instrument. I think there's just this longing to be able to create sound that is not so impulsively cognitive.
Does it matter whether the person is tone deaf or not? I have a friend who cannot sing in tune.
Well, when you see that friend next, hum right into the cheek, because sometimes the bone conduction and skin conduction can take a voice and actually tune it up. Do you know the right ear and the left ear are different? And I've worked with kids who I will sing just a tone, ooh, into the right ear, and they would sing, hmm. And then I would go to the other ear, hmm, and they could match the tone. I think it's like handedness sometimes in certain frequency ranges. And the scary part is if you become so technical in this, like is necessary with great audiologists and people within the listening program and what is being done in advanced brain technologies and all of these things can intimidate people. On the other hand, some of the listening skills are actually very simple.
We're going to take a little break. We're going to go out with a track from a CD that accompanies the book. This is Michael Hopp's Waltz for Raphael. And the book we are talking about is Healing at the Speed of Sound. It's written by Don Campbell and Alex Doman and published by Hudson Street Press. Mozart's theme and variations from the clarinet quintet in A major. This is part of a two-volume CD set called Focus and Vitality. What do you hope to achieve with it?
Healing at the speed of sound. It's, first of all, being very conscious of the sound around you. Number two, developing your own personal playlist. And it's not just your favorites. It's finding what are those things that have sonic caffeine in your life and where are the sonic sedatives? And are you willing to try the taste of new sounds that will help calm you down? You know, it's just amazing. What can happen in 20 and 30 seconds with music can just get you out of a mood into another. I just wonder if it's legal.
Well, Mozart also wrote a dissonant string quartet. Will that have a different effect? The reason I ask is a listener has written in wondering whether some of the new music, which is dissonant, is inspired by the modern urban experience, and does listening to too much dissonance, even musical dissonance, create stress?
I think it does, but stress is interesting. If you study the physiological aspects of stress, you know, if you make a fist very tight and then relax it, you're more relaxed than when you first started making that fist. In other words, doing progressive relaxation techniques. One thing that we've done in the book in an enhanced edition is I will talk about something and then here's the musical example. Or you can go on an enhanced electronic edition and see a demonstration of it. Or if you want to read the research and you really want to learn about it, it'll take you with a little light bulb to a link with the Noise Association, and where you can find out more. So this is a very strange book because it's like having 15,000 pages and CDs all within its covers.
A listener on the Upper West Side asks, is there a difference between hearing live and recorded sounds or making the music yourself?
Yes.
Oh. I mean, is that – I'm not just talking for your ears because it does have a different impact on your ears, but also your brain?
Oh, of course. The idea of making music, just sounding your voice, if you're a singer, if you put your hand on your cheek, you're going to feel the vibrations of your bones in your cheek. I mean, you're actually massaging yourself. Recorded music sometimes can help you mask the world around you. I have been watching people on the subway all week that I've been in New York, and I noticed sometimes they are really safe, and I just wonder, what are you listening to? I had the best experience yesterday coming all the way downtown. Here was a Marinacci band, and everybody in this car was happy. I mean, you know, they took off their headphones. These beautiful, beautiful Mexican singers. There were four musicians, and it was like I had noticed that in Paris, you know, playing Edith Piaf. Live music is important. But at the same time, too much music is like too much food. It might be very nourishing for you, but you just don't want to keep it going all the time.
I recently visited Paris, and I noticed that the subways are much louder. They're much screechier. They suddenly made New York sound like a silent subway system. And I wondered about the effect it's going to have on or it has on people in Paris.
Well, I think this is just true all over the world. I mean, above ground and underground and in our airports, having noise reduction headphones on, whether you're listening to music or not, takes away and strains some of that stress from the sound itself.
Dave in Manhattan writes, as someone with ADHD, white noise is just added noise and it never fades into the background.
Exactly. White noise, pink noise, and just the normal tinnitus that we develop over age. There's always a kind of ringing in the mind. And at times, how do we learn to modify it? How can we select kinds of music and realize that even our physical diet, carbohydrates, make a difference in the ringing in our ears?
Well, your book is filled with information about how different kinds of students are aided if they also play musical instruments or are involved with music, medical students, for example. So music provides a hook for memory, obviously. Do scientists understand how music helps information, like the alphabet stick in our brains?
I think this is the endless dialogue, and we're always at the beginning of the field. I wrote a book 28 years ago, called Introduction to the Musical Brain, just on creativity, how important it is for a young person, for a parent, for a teacher, to be able to look at the auditory aspect of learning in multisensory contexts. Some kids are movers and shakers. They just need to stand up and dance. Others are more focused and contemplative. It is a balance of using music in the right way, not overusing music ever, and moving the fingers, getting a sense of up and down the piano, the recorder, the guitar. Just watch it, what happens. It gives them an emotional outlet that other things may not be able to do.
So why do you think that arts education, music education, is one of the first things that's cut back whenever there's an economic crisis? I'm not sure that they're teaching kids music in our schools anymore.
I dare say it's vital for our teachers and our musicians to understand a little more about the brain, a little bit more about creativity is more than the artistic result or just entertainment. And that's what I've tried to do in this book, is to show dozens of different ways in which you can use sound and music in your own home, in your own life.
A listener in New York City asks, have you ever heard the recitation of the Quran, and what do you think of the rhythm and musical qualities within it? And I'd like to expand that to chanting in general, because in most religious services, people chant or listen to a recitation of prayers.
Exactly. I was in Syria in 1961. I was in Egypt this year. And the one thing I notice about the recitations of all of these is that now it's blaring through these loudspeakers that just make it overwhelming. It was very different in when the sound was local. In the 70s, I spent some time in Bukhara and Samarkand. And the chanting was effective. Chanting is almost this elongation of intention. Oh, take a deep breath. Elongate your breathing. And there's an intent. There's a reason to chant. It does slow down the brain. We know it's fairly easy now to see, to take the beta waves and kind of slow them down and equalize the brain waves. And there are a lot of different alternative ways to do it. But just learning the humming, learning different aspects of repeating. I mean, I would have never gotten through college without the Greek alphabet to Yankee Doodle. I mean, there are so many different ways that sound and music can be used.
Well, we start off kids with the alphabet A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and we remember that song the rest of our life.
And that's a Mozart melody. A vous diriger mon mot. That's right. But it's also Baba Black Sheep. It's also Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. It is that universal sense that the melody of the voice and what we remember of our parents reading us a story was not a monorhythmic moment. Sometimes the parent was more emotional and embracive by reading about that. I mean, I always have, when I work with parents of young children, I have them all read Goodnight Moon. And there are 1,000 variations, and it's amazing what that voice will say. Somehow, sometimes our dogs understand us more clearly than those others we live with.
My guest is Don Campbell, who's written a book called Healing at the Sound of at the Speed of Sound with Alex Doman. It is published by Hudson Street Press. We've been talking about how sound can have a healing effect and a calming effect. I always worry about for the people who are standing next to me in the subway who have headphones on, and I can hear what they're listening to. I worry, first of all, about the impact it's going to have on their eardrums.
If they're not noise reduction, it can be almost overwhelming. You get into the 90, 120 decibel, it's just overpowering. The sense of even the little pods that you put in your ear, that can make it extreme. Having something that is over the ear and just being able, you don't even have to listen to music if you have a good noise cancellation.
Well, the maximum volume of an Apple iPod is 115 decibels. That's the equivalent of listening to a helicopter take off. And yet many people listen at top volume. Should they be offering them at lower decibel levels?
It's an epidemic. And I think we are going to see, we're already seeing our colleagues in their 30s and 40s who are having hearing loss and severe tinnitus. And I think it's a matter of not being terribly strict, but to be terribly aware.
I grew up with someone who was a drummer with some pretty famous groups, and the amplifiers were always behind him. And he talked about going days with a kind of a shh sound in his ears simply because they had been blasting into him.
Yes, and so often as I enter my 60s, 70s, and 80s, I start speaking louder because I can't quite hear, and it's just so I can hear my own voice. For the last 6 years, I've been a part of an aesthetic audio system, and we've been installing music zones in hospitals, offices, and healthcare centers where you feel the difference. I don't want music everywhere all the time. I don't.
But you say that music can be healing?
Music can help bring an experience to balance. And healing is almost not the same as curation. It is a sense of moving from one place to another to help slow down, to help you take a deep breath, to make an emergency room or surgical waiting very different experience, not having a television on blaring at you, but to have that softer harp music or what we were listening to before, the Michael Hoppe, just something that allows us to give us more space.
Some of the studies you've discussed in your book involve subjects wearing bone-conducting headphones. What are bone-conducting headphones?
Bone actually travels faster. If you have a tuning fork or anything that buzzes a little bit, you can just put that into your skull, and it's very interesting. Often you'll hear it on the other side of your brain. Bone conduction headphones started in World War II, where pilots couldn't understand each other. It was so loud that they found that by putting bone conduction in their headphones, they could hear each other because the air conduction was not interrupted. So this is something that is used in auditory clinics, even when you get a good audiological test. Now there are listening tests that help you realize how well you can focus into one aspect of hearing and memory and speech.
Do people need to wear bone-conducting headphones to get the full benefit of the music they're listening to?
No, I don't think so. I think the first thing is to be very aware of the world around you and how much sound stimulation you're getting every day. Do you actually chill out at any point? And in a secondary sense, look at this is kind of a funny phrase, but what is the acoustic perfume in your life? Is it at the Bach Goldberg Variations, or is it Adele, or is it Bobby McFerrin with that fabulous voice that just gives you that amuse écouter, or that wonderful sense. Start paying attention. This is the personal playlist context. Oh, and every month I give a free hour teleconference of people with questions and how to use what we know about sound today.
Well, I listen to different kinds of music at different times. If I'm exercising, I want up-tempo music. And when I'm relaxing, Bach-Goldberg variations or Bill Evans is preferred.
But when you exercise, it's very important, and I hope a lot of people are listening to this one point. If you use headphones and you're running or you're in a cycling class or whatever, after about 8 minutes, turn down the volume because you are the circulation in your ear, the oxygenation of your ear, you become more sensitive and the sound may have a more detrimental effect. So start out with the sound you need to activate you, but then calm it down. You'll still be able to exercise and move and feel yourself engaged in the music.
You write about an increasing number of healthcare professionals and educators who've been experimenting with vibroacoustic therapy, which involves transmitting music that has a barely perceptible low-frequency sound vibration through speakers directly into the bodies of patients who have Parkinson's disease, cystic fibrosis, cerebral palsy, and autism. Can you tell us how that works?
I think there's a lot of good experimentation. I think there's a lot of kind of wild, off-the-edge kinds of things having it as well. Let me make a sample. Do you remember being on a school bus when you were a kid and in the afternoon, and then you'd put your head against that window and feel that, and it was kind of like, this feels good. It kind of takes away everything else. There are vibratory beds. There are amazing crystal bowls. There are things in which that give us a sense of sound in our body because skin and bone translates sound as well. I wish there was a magic touch of just one frequency or one piece of music because that will do the same thing for everybody, but that's not true. What is true is that looking at, well, you played wonderful Mozart at the end. That's more stimulating. That's from Music for Healing at the Speed of Sound to help you focus, to help organize the mind and the body. The first two pieces you played were from Calm and Relaxing. It's just beginning to pay attention and make silence as important as sound in your life.
You also discussed two recent studies conducted in Sweden that showed that the act of humming can create vibrations in the sinuses that help prevent chronic sinus infections. We're clearing out our sinuses by humming?
No doubt. Everybody can do it. That's what I do on the subway. That's what I do on the airplane when I don't have my headphones with me.
People think you're meditating.
No, they can't hear a thing. They really don't. Anyway, I'm a contemplative. You know what a contemplative is? It's somebody who tries to meditate and can't ever quite figure out how to do it. But literally, if you vibrate your breath, and there's a whole chapter about this. Actually, I've written a book or two about it. What you can do for your mind and your body with the sound of your breath and even with certain vowel sounds. As you're driving late at night, is like sonic caffeine. You'll start yawning. Now, you don't want to do this with too many people around, but I have found if you really want a seat on the subway, just start singing E and people will get out of the way. I think that's what Moses really did with the Red Sea.
At the end of your book, you identify 20 types of listening styles. Can you tell us about some of them?
Yes. Nadia Boulanger said to me early, "Oh, there is nothing boring in your life except yourself. There is no bad music. There's only music that you will not change for yourself." And I didn't know what that meant. But now I realize that I can go to a concert and the rhythm takes me over. Sometimes the melody. Last night, seeing that pianist and sitting under the piano, I never sit that close. I was a performer watcher. The rhythm, the melody, there are ways to change the gyroscope of our consciousness so that we are just not sitting there waiting for it to come over us like a tone bather.
But you tell a story about attending a Mozart concert in Tokyo and not being able to appreciate the music as fully as the elderly woman who was sitting next to you.
I'll never forget it. I was a music critic in Tokyo for 7 years. And it was early in my career, and I went to an all-Mozart conference. It was the Tokyo Philharmonic, but it was very common that they would just double the size of the orchestra. Well, I knew it was not a chamber orchestra, and it was kind of the Ormandy style, which is not my favorite. And I was sitting next to a little boy and a woman in kimono. And they did a piano concerto, and it was lovely, but it was schmaltzy. It had a lot of sugar in it. And I was so in my mind, and the little boy was just thrilled because it was his violin teacher who was playing, and the lady in kimono, she says, "That's the most beautiful thing of all creation I've ever heard." And I thought, I missed the boat. And I always have to say, I have no idea what you're hearing and what your potential is about in sound. I just want you to do it safely. And that's what Healing at the Speed of Sound is about, is for you to have these tools.
We're going to go out with Vivaldi's Allegro 1, Opus 3, Concertino number 8 in A minor. Is this supposed to relax me or stimulate me?
Here we are.
Stimulating.
It's 1 in the afternoon, and if you're not careful, it's the optimal time for minimal learning, but this will floss you for the afternoon.
Thank you so much for being with us, Don Campbell. Latest book is Healing at the Speed of Sound, written with Alex Doman and published by Hudson Street Press. Thank you.